down the byways all alone. I'm still searching for my home. Up in the morning, out on the road. Yeah, my head is aching. Yeah, my hands are cold. And I'm looking for the silver lining in the clouds. And I'm searching for, and I'm searching for no philosopher's stone. And it's a hard road, it's a hard road, daddy o. When my job is turning lead into gold.
Philosopher's Stone, Van Morrison. Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host and producer of the show, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers and advocates from around the world. Unspun is a call-in show. We invite questions and comments from our listeners. Our number in the studio is 530-337-1885. 530-337-1885. We are streaming live on the internet at kkrn.org. Click on the listen button. Today, our guest on the phone is Greg Pallas. Greg Pallas is an internationally known investigative reporter for The Guardian and the BBC, and author of several New York Times international bestsellers, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, Armed to Madhouse, Vulture's Picnic, and Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. He has done many exposés, among them the purging of thousands of African Americans from Florida's voter polls in 2000 by Catherine Harris. He is also the recipient of the George Orwell Courage and Journalism Prize for his BBC television documentary, Bush Family Fortunes. Greg has a new film out now called Vultures and Vote Rustlers. You can check out the trailer and get the DVD or download it at gregpallas.com. You can also follow him and like him on Facebook at Greg Pallas Investigates. Well, let's welcome Greg Pallas. Greg, welcome to Unspun. Well, we've got Greg back with us now. We reestablished that line. Greg Pallas, good morning and welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling.
Glad to be with you.
Well, it's been 2 years, almost 2 years since we had you on. I think we had you on in July 2012, and a whole lot has happened. I know you've been busy that 2 years, and I thought maybe we could start by talking about, I know you covered the Chavez, the attempted coup of Chavez in Venezuela, and I was just wondering, since we the U.S. seems to be going on a kind of a little coup rampage around the world, I'm in my thinking Honduras, Libya, Syria, Venezuela, the Ukraine are probably among those, and my question for you, is this the future of American foreign policy? Are we going to keep going down this road?
Well, I don't think it's we. I think it's an elite. I think that what we have is, in the case of Venezuela, for example, and if you go to gregpallas.com, you'll see a picture of me with the current president of Venezuela, who stopped by my office, Nicolas Maduro. And I knew the prior president, Hugo Chavez, and the opposition. I knew those guys, too. I deal with lots of heads of state in my work at BBC television. And, you know, what's going on in Venezuela is real simple. They're sitting on a lot of oil. And as far as some of our oil elites, of our oil oligarchs in the America believe, it's our oil. And they seem to have trouble giving it to us at a price that will make our oil chieftains happy. In fact, by the way, if you go to gregpalace.com, I've arranged through my foundation to make a film about Venezuela available for free. Normally, I have to obviously pay for these things, but you can get a full-length film about called The Assassination of Hugo Chavez. If you go to gregpalace.com, you can download that for free. But what's happened is that Venezuela has the world's biggest reserves of oil. And what I mean is way bigger than Saudi Arabia, even by OPEC's official and the U.S. official analysis. And the thing is that they just won't give it to us very cheaply. The number one purchaser of Venezuelan oil in the planet is the Corpus Christi refinery in Houston, Texas. And that's owned by Koch Industries. The Koch brothers own that. They're Venezuela's number one customer. And what they don't like is that Venezuela charges a nice high price for that oil. Now, why does a Texas refinery need Venezuelan oil? Why not Texas oil when you can see oil wells from the refinery itself? The answer is that Texas West Intermediary oil is light crude, and the Koch refinery can only handle super heavy crude, which can only be found two places in the world. One is Venezuela, where they've been getting it, and the other is from Canada, from the, you know, if you liquefy the tar sands. And that's why, by the way, they want an XL pipeline. The Kochs don't own any of that pipeline. What they own is that all the oil ends up at their place at about a $30 a barrel savings, which is why we'd run a pipeline across the U.S. to send oil to Texas. I mean, no one seems to ask why we send oil to Texas of all places, but that's why, so the Kochs can save about $2 billion a year. If they can't save that money by getting a pipeline, that seems to be a problem because of environmentalists complaining. The other is to get rid of Hugo Chavez's government, now his successor, a guy named Nicolas Maduro. And if we get rid of those guys, the Koch brothers can get cheap oil. Now, does that mean that you and I get cheap oil? Every time the price of oil goes down on the international market, I don't see the price of the pump dropping. I'm paying over $4 a gallon. I don't know about you. So, you know, it's not like it's for us. It's for them. So this is all about oil. So do we have attempts to overthrow elected governments? Remember, the government of Venezuela is elected. Do we overthrow elected governments for a few rich guys to get a little richer? Yeah, that's happened. It's happening now.
So do you put Ukraine in that same basket? I don't know how much you've looked into it. From what I've looked into it, it looks like another U.S.-backed coup to me.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. involved. I mean, there's a tremendous ethnic split in the Ukraine, obviously, between Ukrainian ethnics and Russian ethnics. I have a member of the Greg Palast investigative team, really quite a whole team, just that you see Greg Palast's nose on camera. But there's a huge investigative team, and one of our members is Ukrainian, who's there, and we just sent Zach Roberts, our photojournalist, who was just in Kiev a couple weeks ago. And what we're finding is, you know, obviously there's some frightening elements on both sides. Putin is no sweetheart. But again, this has to do with control of resources and capital. And in the case of the Ukraine, the country was about to sign a deal with the European Union under terms imposed by the International Monetary Fund. And the IMF basically was kind of terms of surrender. I mean, it was basically turn over all your privatized industry, privatize all your resource industries. Now, what that means is that you sell them to the Germans cheap. So you'd have a German economic takeover of the country. In addition, you will pass. Ukraine doesn't have any hydrocarbon resource like oil or gas, but they get it from Russia, and the Europeans wanted the Ukraine to turn over the gas they get from Russia cheap. And in addition, you know, they wanted to impose all those things like, you know, austerity, meaning fire, you know, end all your government services, you know, fire teachers, fire policemen, sell off your water systems, you know, sell off your bus lines and your train systems, etc. It was pretty harsh conditions for being able to trade with Europe, not join Europe. There's no way the European Union would let 47 million Ukrainians have the right to move to other parts of Europe. That ain't happening. But to, just to trade with Europe. So Putin saw an opening in which he said, "Oh, hey, the Europeans want your blood and your firstborn. I'll tell you what, I'll give you $15 billion, no strings attached, and cheap heating gas if you skip the Europeans and join my pact." So you know, the European Union, the Germans in particular, decided that it would be a very good time to have an ethnic uprising of ethnic Ukrainians. Not all of them, but some of them very right-wing, wearing stormtrooper outfits and, you know, painting swastikas everywhere. By the way, my photographer has plenty of photos of this stuff. And so you end up with a so-called democratic uprising, which is pretty funny because I always thought that democracy involved elections. and the guy that was there, not a sweetheart, this Yanukovych. He is the Russian ethnic, and but he was elected because most of the people there are Russian ethnic, and he was elected president, and he was overthrown. So somehow overthrowing an elected president with a bunch of stormtroopers is somehow that's democracy. And so then the Russians, not unexpectedly, said, "Well, you know, Crimea is basically entirely Russian and is our main Russian naval base, and so we'll let the people of Crimea vote with whom they want to join." And obviously, the Russians of Crimea decided that to be part of Russia. Plus, they got the extra bonus that their pensions triple overnight. Not a bad deal if you vote for it, right? And so, you know, and so now we're all up in arms of the U.S. State Department, and that kind of slow wit John Kerry is all up in arms about Russian aggression. Unless I'm wrong, it was Russia that allowed the Ukraine to split off. And so if we allow the Ukraine to split off, why can't those parts that didn't want to split return to where the people either were for or against self-determination? We have to make a decision. And so we can't say the Ukrainians can determine to be independent of Russia, but the Crimeans can have no right to determine if they want to be part of Ukraine. So, you know, so, but it's not a, you know, it's really all about, again, the IMF attempted takeover, the German economic takeover of Ukraine. That's what it really comes down to.
Yeah, the we're quick to the U.S. government is quick to recognize some coups and not so quick to recognize others. In Egypt, they kept sending millions and millions of dollars to the military, who eventually overthrew that elected government, and now we're backing whoever these neo-Nazis or whatever this group is. Nobody's really sure, I don't think, except we know that it was all put in place with the help of our State Department. So it looks like another coup that we want to recognize. We've done this so many times, Haiti, Honduras. I mean, we've done it numerous times, and yet the American public doesn't seem to see the pattern, or simply just believes that America is such a righteous force in the world, it's all okay.
Well, you know, now, like in the case of Venezuela, again, I have a film, The Assassination of Hugo Chavez, which you can download for free at my site. I did this for BBC Television. By the way, that's metaphoric. Chavez was not assassinated. They would have loved to have done it. He He died of cancer. He drank himself to death. Coffee. He never touched alcohol, but he had 30 cups of coffee a day and ended up with stomach cancer. But the, you know, the problem for Venezuela is that they have our oil. as far as the Koch brothers are concerned, it's their oil, and how come, you know, they're charging us for it? So we have an elected government in Venezuela. Jimmy Carter, by the way, hated Hugo Chavez. He really did. But he said, you know, and he has his little group that monitors elections. Venezuela's have the most honest elections of any nation in the world. That includes the United States. And, you know, Chavez and now his successor Maduro were elected. But on the other hand, if you'd be surprised how much we would love these guys if they sold us their oil cheap. But as President Chavez told me, we're not an oil colony anymore. We'll sell you oil at a fair price. That's it, you know, and, you know, obviously that just ain't good enough for the Koch brothers. And I don't say good enough for the United States, because neither you nor I get a piece of that action. When we overthrow the government of Venezuela, if we're trying to, and cheap oil comes into the Koch industries at Corpus Christi, I don't think they're going to be giving us a discount on that oil. So then that's the problem. We've been fomenting trouble all over the place, and from, you know, even in Iraq, where, by the way, the idea of Iraq was not to get the oil, but to prevent it from hitting the market, keeping the price of oil up, and that's the real story behind it. So, you know, in my film Vultures and Vote Rustlers, I talk about these oil nations, you know, these oil colonies, including nations like Azerbaijan, which you may have never even heard of, in the Caspian Sea, where BP gets its oil, and then another third world nation called Louisiana, where the Deepwater Horizon blew up and went down. That's another third world nation, which is nominally part of America, but it's controlled by the oil industry. And so in my film, if you go to GregPowles.com, see Vultures of Vote Rustlers, you will see the real story that they don't want to tell you about the Deepwater Horizon, which, by the way, went down 4 years ago next week.
Yeah, all of these things. You've also written about Fukushima, which was just a little over 3 years ago in March. And
right.
Then the Exxon Valdez you reported on, that was also, 25 years ago in March.
Right.
Yeah, we have all these horrendous environmental, I shouldn't call them accidents, should I?
they're man-made disasters. Not deliberate, but it's all about corporate fraud and negligence. That's what I do. Greg Powles is a corporate fraud investigator. That's what I did before. Before I was an investigative reporter, I was an investigator of racketeering and fraud for the U.S. government. That's when we used to actually bust the bad guys.
And prosecute
them.
Don't
do that anymore. Right? That doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
I don't do that. I just do journalism for BBC Television and The Guardian. And the in the case of the Deepwater Horizon, you'll see in my new film that, we got this whole baloney idea from British Petroleum. Oh, it was a terrible accident. You know, the well blew out, and seven men were incinerated, and the thing sank, and 600 miles of Gulf Coast was completely demolished. And by the way, those on the Gulf Coast know darn well that no matter what they tell you, that oil is still there. And what I found out, and you'll see this in my little film, Vultures and Vote Rustlers, what I found out is that there was another blowout just 17 months earlier, an identical blowout on a BP transocean rig, same thing, but in the Caspian Sea on the other side of the world, and BP and its partners covered it up so that we didn't know about it. And the reason they don't want you to know about it is that the one in the Caspian Sea blew out for the exact same reason as the one in the Gulf. It blew out because they had used something called quick dry cement, which is a cheap They put nitrogen in the cement, makes cement like a milkshake, so it dries faster. Time is money in these when you're drilling for oil. And so using this cheap money-saving process, they ended up blowing out a rig in the Caspian Sea, covered it up, and continued to use this cheap crap process in the Gulf. The result, 11 men die, the Gulf Coast gets smeared. And 2 weeks ago, the Obama administration gave BP another lease track to drill right next to where the Deepwater Horizon went down. And so, you know, so BP's laughing. They got away with it in the Caspian. They got away with it in the Gulf now. And there you go. It's and the oil's still out there. So, you know, so these guys do very well. And they do it very well whether they're under the so-called oil dictatorship of Bush and Cheney and or under the oily dictatorship of Obama. So, you know, it's kind of a bipartisan drill fest.
In your latest Vultures what is it? Vultures and
boat
rustlers. Yeah, the Kochs, who are apparently among the new oligarchy of America, are trying to buy up the elections, or at least suppress. Yeah. I'll let you say it, but I find it amazing that they seem to be everywhere. All these billionaires are all of a sudden, and maybe that has to do with the Supreme Court cases. Recent cases that have been decided, but maybe you could tell our listeners. Well, let me remind the listeners first that you're listening to Unspun and Experiment Truth Telling. We have Greg Palison with us, investigative journalist, international best-selling author. And if you want to call in, the number here in the studio is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. So back to the vote wrestlers.
Well, yeah, so what's happened is, you'll see actually if you download the Vultures and Vote Rustlers at GregPalace.com, it ends, by the way, with a little cartoon by the great Ted Rall of the Christies feeding their latest chickadee, Chris Christie. That's why, I mean, if he may look like he's bloated, that's not from fat, that's from all the Koch brothers' money. And that they stuff him with. The thing is that Chris Christie is backed by something called Campaign for Our Children's Future. You have all these wonderful ads saying what a wonderful guy Chris Christie is. The New York Times ran an investigation the way the Times does. They ask Christie, where's this money coming from? And the answer was his old college buddies, his roommates and college buddies. He went to he didn't go to Harvard or anything, he went to Seton Hall. These are not rich guys, so but they seem to have put together, you know, money for TV ads. Well, I added up $6 million worth of television ads. Now, I have a lot of friends I went to school with, and they don't have $6 million to run ads about how wonderful I am. So who is really behind Committee for Our Children's Future? Well, I have some very old files. I've been keeping files on the Brothers Koch since way before they became a household name a couple years ago. Since 1995, I did an investigation called The Richest Guys You've Never Heard Of. And sure enough, back in 1995, these guys had a front organization called Committee for Our Children's Future, the exact group that was putting money behind Chris Christie. And in 95, the money that they were putting up to back candidates by supporting Newt Gingrich and supporting Bob Dole, who was running for president, it was illegal because the money came from Koch Industries. That was a crime at the time because it was before the Citizens United decisions, corporations could not give money to election campaigns. So it was, you know, it was a crime, and they were putting in this money into these campaigns secretly through their corporation. But one thing the Kochs are very good at, and this is the billionaire's rule, and this is Democrats and Republicans. If you break a crime, if you break the law, the answer is, and you get caught, just change the law. They got caught by Senate investigators and the FBI. So they simply were able to cut the deal to get the law changed. And that's how you have Citizens United with the decision of the Supreme Court. They put their guys on the court until their illegal behavior became legal. So now they're legal citizens for our children's future. Has been backing Chris Christie. This is before he decided to block the George Washington Bridge, and that created a little bit of a problem for him.
We've got Greg. Let me interrupt you because we got a caller on the line. He's been waiting a little while. Let me bring him.
Sure, happy to speak to him.
Yeah, let's bring him on the air. Morrow, you're on the air with Greg Palace.
Hey, Morrow.
Hey, good morning. I just want to say hi to Greg Palace. You're one of my biggest heroes ever.
Thank you.
I want to veer off just a little bit and ask you, with so much coming out on 9/11, there's about 15 documentaries now. Even the Airline Pilots Association have theirs, for airline pilots for 9/11 Truth. They have their own documentary. And there's so much concrete evidence. Unlike Kennedy, it took us 30, 40 years to get down to what may have really happened. We've done this pretty quick in 10 years. Do you think we're ever going to get around to grabbing those guys, the elite who pulled that one off?
I have no idea what happened in 9/11 because, I'm an investigative reporter, so since I haven't investigated it, there's nothing I can report about it. You know, I'm shocked at nothing because I see a lot of evil stuff happen all over the world. But here's one story that I haven't covered, so I don't know what to tell you about that one. You know, I mean, I'm covering the rich guys, and that's plenty for me to cover.
All okay, right. Fair enough. Thank you.
Thank you, Morrow. Yeah, 9/11, there's a lot of people looking into 9/11 Truth, architects and engineers, and people can go online and find out more about that. I'm surprised you haven't looked into it because there's several very rich people that supposedly were involved, I think.
Well, I think what it is that since you have so many people looking at these things, I tend to go where no one's looking. My reports tend to be, actually, that's kind of one of my tricks, the kind of Greg Palace thing, is to take the stories that no one is looking at. For example, in Vultures and Vote Rustlers, like in my book, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, I looked into the auto bailout. And what I found is that four billionaires took down the U.S. Treasury through a system that even one of the top U.S. Treasury officials called extortion. They extorted $12 billion out of the U.S. Treasury. This is a story that just is not out there. During the auto bailout, they took down $12 billion. Four of these guys personally pocketed $4 billion, a billion each. I'm not talking about their companies or anything like that. Personally pocketed over $1 billion each from the auto bailout. And the way that they did it is that they quietly took control of the auto parts division of General Motors, Delphi, which used to be Delco, and they said, if you don't give us the money we want, we've got to buy the ball bearings. We're cutting off your parts. And that is literally a quote. We will cut off your parts unless we get our money, $12 billion. And Obama doesn't talk about it. No one talks about it because, you know, the great story is that Obama saved the auto industry. Well, if there's Delphi workers listening, you darn well know where is your job. Your job is in China. This group of four billionaires, they took in $12 billion total, pocketed $4 billion each, and took every single plant, every single auto parts plant from Delphi, all but one, and moved them to China. So every Delphi part, except for one plant, 30 plants, were moved to China. And so, we saved the auto industry for China. and that Obama doesn't like to talk about. And if you think the Republicans are going to bring it up, I don't think so, because the silent partner of these billionaires, a guy, and I'll give you their names, John Paulson is one, Paul the Vulture Singer is another, Dan Loeb is a third one. But the silent partner in there was someone named Ann Romney, the Ann Romney Blind Trust. It ain't too blind, because if I could find it, you bet that the Romneys know what's in their so-called blind trust. The Romneys made about $115 million from the from the auto bailout that never came out publicly, nicely hidden. Even Obama wouldn't bring it out because his myth is that he saved all the jobs, not that 30,000 jobs went kapoof and moved to China. So, yeah, maybe, you know, that's the type of thing that I'm looking at that no one is watching. It's what the billionaires are taking from our pockets. And you know what? In a way, I don't care if billionaires make billions. That's not my concern. It's how they do it. We paid for it. Basically, the American public paid billions of dollars to the ultra-rich to move our jobs to China. That's what happened.
Yeah, and the fact that they seem to be subverting democracy not only around the world, but also in America. I know you reported about some of the voter suppression that's going on, and a lot of that comes around from around the, I believe it's Alec, who is working for the same elite powers that be in corporations to change our election laws.
Yeah, I mean, it's real simple. They don't, you know, they don't want you to vote because it's, you know, when you're talking about the division of the rich and poor, it's, you know, it's, I'd say, you know, to use that Occupy Wall Street phrase, it's the 1% versus 99%. Now, you do the arithmetic. If the 99% vote, the 1% ain't going to do too well. So the answer is to con, you know, they can kind of fool most of the people, most of the time, as Abe Lincoln said. But not all the people, all the time. So as long as they have most, what do they do with the rest of the people who are kind of like half awake and figure something's wrong? They don't let you vote or don't let your vote count. For example, the Koch brothers have a massive, massive database operation called Themis. Now, the NSA is jealous of Themis. The NSA, we complain about the NSA documents. They don't have nothing compared to the database information contained by Themis. Themis can tell you if you downloaded pornography 20 minutes before you voted. And that's legal, by the way. You know, you sign all those. Remember when you get a piece of software and there's 12 pages and you say, I agree? Well, basically, you just agreed to give the Koch brothers everything you've ever looked at, thought, bought, you name it. That's what's in those waivers. And so once they have this massive database, Themis, on every American living and dead, and, for example, they'll use gimmicks like one of their associates for the Koch brothers operation sent out letters to gun owners in Wisconsin who, according to their databases, own guns, registered Democrat, and tended to vote absentee. So they sent them notes saying, listen, here's the, don't forget to get your absentee ballot, and, you know, protect your gun, get your absentee ballot, and here's where you request it, and here's where you mail it in, and make sure you do it by this date. Well, the addresses and the dates and the information are all wrong. So if anyone got that message and followed it, their vote went in the garbage can. And by the way, they don't even know it. You know, we have about 25 to 30 million people in America in a presidential race who mail in their ballots. Man, you mail in your ballot, that's a crapshoot. You are handing your ballot to people who don't want to count it. And, you know, there's all kinds of shenanigans. About one-fourth of those ballots never get counted. I want to repeat that. You mail in your ballot, the chance is only about one out of four that no one will ever count that ballot, because if you registered, for example, and included your middle initial, But on the outside of the envelope, on the return address, you did not include your middle initial, they can throw it out. If your return address doesn't match your other address, or they say it's a suspicious signature, whatever that means, if it says put in your driver's license number and you don't drive, so you left it blank, you will lose your vote, that type of thing. The chance of getting your ballot counted if you mail it in, you know, it's a kind of ballot Russian roulette. We don't count all the votes in America. That's our dirty little secret. And the problem is, who's not counting and who does count? And that's the danger here. That's just one of the dumb tricks that they use. And they're very sophisticated because they know who you are because they have the database information on you.
We've got another question here from Willie in the studio, so I'm going to put Willie on the mic and
hey, Willie.
Let him ask his question. Go ahead, Willie.
Hey, Greg. Well, thank you very much for everything you do and all that you take in and then bring out to all of us.
Thanks.
My question is, how do you deal with it? How do you deal with the frustrations? How do you deal with the – because even sitting here with Doug and his show, I get a lot of stuff that's incredibly frustrating that this is going on and I feel rather inadequate in my ability to handle it and my ability to do anything about it. How do you deal with that frustration? How do you go through it?
Honestly, sometimes I don't, you know. I just say the hell with it, and I just don't want to get up in the morning and pull the covers over my head. I can't say that I can wonderfully face it all every day.
Yeah.
Because I do get frustrated. I'll do major reports, like that report I did on the billionaires who took off with our money and sent the auto jobs to China. That was on the cover of Nation magazine, and yet you never saw it anywhere else on any media in America. That's because, according to the AP reporter, and everyone gets their news from AP, and this is a quote, "For the first time in my 30-year career, I was called by AP Washington and told you can't touch this story, period. It was a dead straight spike." So, you know, it is frustrating, but the way I look at it is that, you know, we got a great show here. The word does get out. They can't, you know, plug all the holes in the information dike. It leaks out, you know, and people start getting wise. And we've had some very, very successful movements in the United States, from the abolition movement to the labor movement to, you know, lately the Patriot movement, and then the anti-globalization movement, and the United States of America itself is, a successful uprising against the World Trade Organization, which at the time was called the British Empire. So, you know, people do get wise, get the info. Between the internet and some, you know, hidden places on the radio dial, etc. And, you know, go to gregpalace.com, spread the word around, and people get it. You know, in the 1770s, Tom Paine wrote the biggest bestseller per capita in American history called Common Sense. And every household in America had a copy of Common Sense. And from there, they said, we won't take it anymore, and overthrew the British World Trade Organization. Hmm. You know, they don't win them all. They really don't.
Yes.
There's 99% is more than 1%. And if the 99% get the stupid out of their heads, we're fine.
Hmm. Well, you're an unsung hero. And I know others know your song, but it's very powerful, and I thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Willie. Well, I want to revisit let me remind these listeners one more time. We can get a chance to get people on the line here. You're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. We have with us Greg Palace, a renowned investigator, investigative journalist for the BBC and for The Guardian in England. best-selling author of several books, all of them great, and you can go to his website, gregpalace.com, to look at those and even download some of them. And you have a chance to ask him questions right now if you call in, 530-337-1885, 337-1885. Well, I'd like to go back some of the investigative stuff you've done over the years, and I wanted to revisit Fukushima because so many people just don't know what happened there. They just think, oh, well, it just failed because of the earthquake and tsunami. But your reporting says something different, does it not?
Yes. Well, you know, if you listen to CNN, you get the official word. There's Anderson Cooper, who's just, you know, when they were handing out the facts, he was at the gym, and they're saying, oh, don't worry about this, you know, don't worry about Fukushima. And then the official line is that there was an unexpected massive earthquake and tidal wave, and that's what destroyed the plant at Fukushima. And that's a wonderful fairy tale because it tells you about a total freak event, and who could have figured it? Well, except the problem with that story is that it's a complete lie. Now, as it happened, I was the chief investigator in the racketeering case against the nuclear industry in the United States for falsifications of papers to the federal and to the government. One of the charges I brought, and this is right on point, was that the biggest builder of nuclear plants in America, at that time called Stone and Webster, the biggest builder of nuclear plants was faking the earthquake proofing tests and faking the earthquake proofing machinery. It has to do with how you tighten bolts and how you, it's called seismic qualification. And they simply made it up. They had a an engineer who was reviewing the ability of nuclear plants to withstand earthquakes, and he gave them a fail. He was told, if you want your job, you change fail to pass. This guy, it was an engineer named Bob Weasel, as a matter of fact. And I was able to get his original documents, which said these, it said, and this is a quote, "These plants will utterly fail in the event of an earthquake." Utterly fail in the event of an earthquake. They knew. And the Japanese plants are based on the U.S. designs whose testing had been faked. So they knew it couldn't withstand earthquake. And by the way, it was not a 9.0 earthquake. Yes, it was a 9.0 monster earthquake outside Fukushima, but in the Pacific Ocean. Now, if those, you know, if, like, I grew up in California. If you have an earthquake in San Francisco, your dishes may rattle a teeny bit in Los Angeles, but you don't have a massive earthquake in Los Angeles because you have one in San Francisco. This is 9.0 in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. By the time it hit Fukushima, it was nothing close to 9.0. It was much less than what the plant was supposed to withstand, and it didn't. That's because they faked the test. In addition, we were supposed to be saved, you know, the people of Fukushima and us. By the way, that crap drifts over on the jet stream. It drifts over to the United States, the radiation. That radiation was not supposed to be released because the diesel, there's supposed to be something called emergency diesel generators, which the plant had, as every plant in America has, which is supposed to snap on and keep water running through the plant to keep the fuel from melting down, the radioactive fuel from melting down. That failed. Now, why did it fail? Oh, we got a fairy tale. Oh, there was a big tsunami, and the diesel generators were overwhelmed, you know, were underwater. That's not what happened. Take a look at the satellite photos. The diesel generators at Fukushima were on high ground behind the plant. The seawalls at Fukushima held, and the plant, you know, we have all kinds of photos of houses being floating away and all this stuff. That's not at the plant. You don't see any pictures of the plant flooded because the plant was not flooded. The problem with the diesel generators is that they're simply not capable of turning on an emergency. If there is a mechanical or electrical engineers out there, you know exactly what I'm talking about. These giant diesel generators, they're huge and they're noisy and they're greasy, but they're basically old cruise ship engines, and some of them literally taken off of old cruise ships. They cannot snap on in a matter of seconds at 20,000 RPM, twice their design level. You do that. It's just like as if you ran to your car, turned on the engine, and took off at 120 miles from a dead standstill. You'll throw a rod. The crankshafts on these things snapped. Snap, crackle, pop. The crankshafts busted on these things when they try to turn on. Not only at Fukushima, but at the diesel generators and nuclear plants up and down the coast in Japan. In fact, we had an earthquake event in the East Coast. The North Anna plant had to turn on their diesel generators, and they snapped too. And I can tell you, when I did my investigation to the federal government, we made one nuclear plant, the Shoreham nuclear plant, turn on its diesel generators, not the fake phony tests where they slowly turned them on. We're talking about emergency earthquake disaster where you got to snap them on. All three diesel generators failed. Those diesel generators that we have around every American nuclear plant to protect us in case of an emergency, you might as well put Christmas tinsel around those nuclear plants. It's a con. They're just big old machines that are meant to look impressive, make a lot of noise. But if something goes wrong, baby, they're not going to work for you.
And we have something like, what, 30 to 40 plants that's a GE design. That's the other question I have for you. What's the relationship between this engineering firm that you reported on and GE? Do they work for GE?
Yes. Well, GE, first of all, three GE engineers, the one named Greg Miner and Dale Breidenbauer, there are two of them, they were the main chief design engineers for General Electric. When I was working with the government, they came to me and said, look, we warned GE that these plants were not being designed correctly. Containment shells were not big enough to hold all the equipment. So they can't really properly work and handle these equipment. We can't, you know, it's hard to be able to test whether these pipes are corroding. We've got a disaster on our hands. And this is what I'm talking, not low-level guys. We're talking chief engineers at General Electric came to me when I was working with the government and said these plants are just not safe. So it's not like Fukushima didn't know that that plant was dangerous. They knew that the earthquake proofing was fake. They knew the diesel generators were not worth, you know, garbage. You know, they could have just had toy fire trucks or something outside the plant. They knew all this stuff. The problem, so they say, why would you do that? I mean, why would someone build an unsafe plant? Because it's cheaper. It's cheaper. It's really, really, really expensive to build a nuclear plant safely. I'm not against nuclear power. The problem is that the cost of safe nuclear power is really expensive. If you didn't use those cheap diesel generators, if you had to have basically a second operating plant next to it, continuously operating, like if you had to run those diesel generators day and night so they wouldn't have to be snapped on, that gets really, really, really expensive. If you had to earthquake-proof every plant so it really handled design earthquake, it would be monstrously expensive. As we know, the San Onofre nuclear plant, which is finally closed permanently, it's right on a fault line. I mean, it's just nuts, you know, in California. I mean, it's like, you know, how goofy can you get? So once they make these mistakes, you know, to fix them is billions and billions and billions, and they're not going to, unless you the taxpayer, unless they can find a sucker to pay for it, they're not going to fix this stuff. They can't. It's just way too expensive to build these plants safely. They just, you know, because they'll find something wrong with the diesel generators. And then they lie about it. When we complain that diesel generators might be unsafe, they said, oh, no, we ran tests. Everything was fine. And then we got one engineer to come to the government and say, you know what, they faked the tests. So we said, okay, rerun the tests now. We're watching you. Turn them on at full speed. There were three diesel generators at the Shoreham nuclear plant. Within 15 minutes, all three snapped. All three. And there's no difference between the ones that we tested and every other diesel generator in the United States backing up a nuclear plant. It just doesn't work. If things go down, you're in trouble. And the one time we had those diesel generators had to be turned on. Now, by the way, that nuclear plant at Shoreham was completely dismantled and torn apart. But what upset me about that is that all the problems at that one plant where we found all the problems, all those problems are at every plant. They're at every plant. And they could fix them, but it's billions. It's billions and billions and billions and billions, and they ain't going to pay for it. Not for you. Not for your safety.
Yeah, I thought the interesting thing was that immediately after Jeffrey Immelt, who is the CEO of GE, came mm-hmm. back from the Fukushima incident. He didn't stay there too long. He probably realized the radiation threat. But he was in Tokyo, and then he came back. And like 2 days later, Obama attacked Libya without going through Congress, without an okay, with no UN, look at the situation, nothing. He just went into Libya, which I thought was interesting. And that was the last you heard about Fukushima on the air in any major way.
Yeah, distraction is a big part of the circus. Right, like P.T. Barnum said, there's a sucker born every minute, and in America they vote. And the thing is that we love circus. I just like when Reagan was president and Hezbollah blew the crap out of barracks, killing 600 American Marines. And rather than take on Hezbollah, days later we invaded Grenada. It's a lot easier to take on. It's a hell of a lot easier to take on, do a Club Med war than to go after maniacs like Hezbollah. I mean, but it was a nice distraction. So then we could have a parade about our great victory over, a beach resort in Grenada. So we get wonderfully distracted. Every one of these characters is this. When Nixon, way back when Nixon was facing impeachment, he suddenly put the entire Air Force, our nuclear Air Force, on high alert, getting ready to attack Russia, as if there was some type of sudden threat from Russia. Well, there was no threat from Russia. There was a threat from Congress of impeaching Nixon over Watergate. So, it's like distraction is one of their favorite tools. Every card shark knows that. If you want to stick a card up your sleeve, you got to say, oh, there goes Elvis, right? And so, this is like the old thing in the world. We suddenly have a distracting crisis, and the media is happy, especially if it's CNN, and you can give them, pictures from smart bombs or something like that. And you can have Wolf Blitzer, sit there in front of some type of fake map, and you got some ex-generals sitting there playing with their toy tanks on the air. It's much more interesting than dealing with real issues, isn't it?
Well, yeah, we've only got a couple minutes left here, and I guess just to get your opinion, because you're talking about all of this and how it plays out, are we headed for a new Cold War scenario here? Is that what all this hype is about?
Yeah, don't you love it? I mean, look, the Cold War is a great profit center. We're not going to war with Russia. We're not going to war. Now we're having this whole discussion, we have the South China Sea, and the Chinese want to control the South China Sea, and so now we have to rebuild up our Navy and all that. Look, the Chinese aren't going to attack America. We owe them $3 trillion. If someone owes you $3 trillion, they make sure that you stay very healthy and happy. Last thing they want to do is harm the United States. The United States owes them $3 trillion. Believe me, the Chinese are not going to do anything. They're going to harm the three. Because all we have to do is have an excuse to say, okay, we're now in a state of war, so we're writing off your $3 trillion. Oh, no, I don't think that's happening.
Yeah.
And, Russia has $1 trillion in U.S. Reserve assets. Yeah, so there's lots. And, of course, it helps Putin. Putin's, suddenly the Russian economy is drifting down. And so if you're Putin, and you are Obama, and you're, and you know, people are saying, "Wait, I thought I was supposed to get health care." You start to, you know, so Putin's in trouble, Obama's in trouble. What's the solution? A new Cold War. I wonder if they just actually call up and giggle together, say, "Whose turn is it? We're starting. Okay, if we got a Cold War, isn't it your turn first? Okay, well, how about Ukraine? Oh, that's a good one." Okay, or Afghanistan, Ukraine, Libya. Let's bring in the Chinese. Let's let them put some ships. And we're going to go after some guano islands in the South China Sea, and now we're supposed to be all shaken up, right? So that, you know, yeah. Look, the Cold War is a wonderful profit center. The Politburo of China is suddenly finding that they're struggling to meet their 7% growth rate, which they desperately need to keep their people happy. And Russia's in trouble, Obama's in trouble. So it looks like it's time for a new Cold War. It's like they are kidding me, right? There's no cold. We're not going to be shooting it. We're not going to be fighting the Ruskies anywhere. We're not going to be fighting the Chinese anywhere. But we are going to be spending an awful lot of money on weapons and games and nonsense over this stuff. And, you know, we'll be nicely distracted. So if you want the real story, go to GregPalace.com.
Okay.
And listen to Doug.
Yes. Thank you. That's our little background cue to wind it up. We got less than a minute. So I want to thank you, Greg, for all your work and your contributions. And I will put links to your website and to Facebook, your website there. And thanks once again for being on Unspun, an experiment in truth telling.
Well, Doug, anytime, just join me at GregPalace.com. We'll invite you in, too.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Greg. Bye. Well, you've been listening to Unspun, Experiment in Truth Telling, and as I said, this archives of this show will go up on KKRN's website along with links to Greg Palace's site. So thanks for listening, and have a good weekend.